A universe of questions, cloaked amidst laws set in motion since the dawn of time, perceived solely by those determined, and found only between the realms of black and white. Welcome to the Gray Matters Podcast.
There are moments in time that hold secrets to our instinctual, individual human nature. Moments that provide us a deeper awareness of our subconscious mind. Wounds and victory, they're exposed in these moments. They're usually made manifest by responsive or emotional reaction. In addition to the subconscious mind, there's a much more sentient element in the composition of human nature, which is shaped and transformed through the process of expression, observation, and experience. This is the conscious mind, and this acts as the building blocks of perceived personality. This is the essence of our individual daily being. It's typically made manifest by thoughtful and cognizant reaction. Our reputation, our ambitions, perspective, inclinations, influence, these are all products of both the conscious and the subconscious being. We're composed of those things that we have shaped and those things that others have shaped in us. The mind is an amazing thing, and I welcome you to join me, Brandon Kenyon, as I tell you a tale of human essence, of what shapes us, of self-awareness. Yet another chapter in the saga of the mind I like to call Gray Matters. A word of caution before we get started. While not the case for most episodes in the Gray Matters universe, today's episode contains some disturbing depictions of violence and terror that may not be suitable for younger listeners. Please proceed with caution. Now let's get on with the story. The Machine That Told Time, Part 1. There was fresh blood that saturated the papers as he retrieved them from the printer tray in his dim upstairs bedroom. His hand shook violently as he reached blindly for his chair. He was weak. Too weak to pull the chair out any farther than just to allow him enough room to slide in and set down the crimson pages near a Smith & Wesson MP9. It was still warm. He could feel the radiant heat from the gun when he grabbed his pen. He flipped through some of the pages in order to find one that wasn't quite so wet. Would be too difficult to try and pen quickly on damp pulp, and this warning message needed to count. Two turns of the lamp switch caused it to crackle on, revealing the footprints from the doorway on the white carpet, pooling in the center of the room, then to the printer, and ending at the desk. He was sure some of the blood must be his. There was just too much to only be someone else's. He took a pause for a moment before penning his letter of warning. My name is Officer Harry Jackson. Whoever's reading this, please understand I'm fully lucid and I'm cognizant of the insanity that this is going to be portrayed as. You need to understand that the enemy is not ignorance. But the eventual demise of mankind undoubtedly will be that we were aware of far too much. The moment of demise technology is not safe for our sustainable future. I don't know how else to warn you, reader, but please understand. These may be our last moments as a perceivably rational society. I will account for you my reasoning. I ask that this is not turned over to any broadcast network or public authority, no matter the cost and no matter the gain. I am employed with the New York City Police Department. Until recently, I was assigned the warrant section of the South Manhattan Borough, but I relocated to homicide analysis a few months ago when the so-called moment of demise, or MOD, bracelets were first introduced and our healthcare providers insisted it would cause a revolution in longevity of life. I've been with the force 18 years come April, and I had a long overdue commitment by Central Investigation Inspector Paul Garner to allow me into the unit should the opportunity ever present itself. I guess you could say the door was open when the insurance companies pretty much forced the NYPD warrants section to downsize and teeter on the brink of being obsolete. If you had a MOD, the statistics of committing a crime worthy of your day in court were virtually diminished. And if you didn't have a MOD, well, we've seen that you're most likely not going to be alive long enough to need a warrant. Most of the New York boroughs just relocated the warrant officers like myself to cold case or surveillance and apprehension squads. A few assistant chiefs found it suitable to cut some dead weight or put some old grudges to rest. I guess I got lucky. I was critical of the MOD bracelets from day one. The guys, they call me Healy because I tend to drag my feet with social trends. See, I don't have a MOD, regardless of the incentives the force has put on getting one. I comprehend the appeal. You allow your healthcare provider to monitor and report and archive your every decision for the purpose of the MOD to give constant feedback pertaining to your remaining time on Earth. I understand the face value. But honestly, why would anyone subject themselves to the constant monitoring and reporting of their heart rate, their blood chemical contents, their nervous response? That constant digital display, reporting months, days, hours, seconds before you sound your final whimper and your blood runs cold. I've seen the calendars on bedroom walls, counting down the days a family member was destined to die with X's on the dates like some debauched holiday. There are some things we're better off not knowing. Insurance companies, employers, friends, families, enemies, world leaders, please, readers, stop and evaluate what this information could be used for, or who it can be used against. My wife has always joked about my social awkwardness and lack of awareness to modern trends, and honestly, maybe she was right. Maybe I wouldn't be where I am today had I just listened. I guess I could have better known that answer with a MOD to tell me how many minutes I had left on this earth, but no matter how long you get that MOD to add minutes to your lifespan, we're all ticking down to zero eventually. I saw a lot of dead bodies not long after moving to the homicide analysis unit. No surprise there, I suppose. I don't recall even one of those bodies with a moment of demise bracelet. There was this rational line of conclusion that I kept on hearing time and time again. If they had a MOD, they would have avoided this. But who can say? Honestly, when it's your time to go, it's time to go. But this mentality further fueled the machine, and I started getting pressure from our insurance companies. I paid a lot to keep my wrist clear of a MOD, and it kept getting more and more expensive to maintain my perceived ignorance. Within the span of a few short months, I saw fewer and fewer people without MODs, and our cases became less and less frequent. But they always involved a victim that didn't know the moment that they would take their final breath. I once watched a man writhe in his own intestines that were spilled out on an asphalt driveway. He was screaming for a final word with his teenage daughter who lay lifeless near their minivan. Neither of them had a MOD bracelet. Maybe he could have prevented the armed robbery and subsequent slaughter had he just slapped one on. But his wife later told me that he was afraid it would become his obsession. I've seen that obsession. I fear the same. The beginning of what you see in my living room and bedroom has everything to do with obsession. My recollection of what seems like years ago is not hyperbolized. You'll have doubts in the authenticity of my observations, but I simply ask two things of you. Firstly, that you recognize I am taking the time to pen these words very thoughtfully, very concisely. Please read my words in their entirety. Second, remember what they've told you. The media, the politicians, your employer, the wealthy, your family. Remember how you've been told repeatedly that submission brings self-governance. Liberty comes through bondage. I feel obligated to speak to the nature of where my story begins. Society's view of guys like me. This, no doubt, is nothing new to you, but it bears importance. Of course, the supposed primary goal of the mod is to incentivize the wearer to make correct choices moment by moment, to extend the total minutes the wearer spends on God's green earth. The supplementary goal of the device is to increase your longevity score, which in turn acts as the incentive to support the primary goal. Longevity could be increased by, say, suppressing the urge for a cigarette or spending a few extra minutes on your run. It opens you up to some pretty great perks, which I've never been able to cash in on, never having a longevity score. It was routine for the other officers on the NYPD to go out for team-building longevity-exclusive events. Almost mandatory, it seemed. I walked to and from the precinct most days and found myself searching madly for some non-discriminate restaurant or venue that my wife and I could visit. It was humiliating when she'd hear I didn't receive an invite to a company event. I don't think she's ever understood why I couldn't just swallow my pride and conform to the rest of society. If I'm being honest, I never fully understood why. I didn't have an assigned partner. That's not the way it works in my field. I worked alone, typically in the office for the majority of my routine. The day that fostered my first encounter with the Cheshire Man was no different than most. I checked in for a brief on a fresh case. I spent my ritualistic time over the coffee pot with Community Patrol Officer Phil Rosario and settled into my workstation, a freshly stuffed manila envelope in hand. I thumbed through some of the case notes and fired up my laptop. The case I'd been assigned to review was for a 23-year-old girl who had just been murdered a mere 90 minutes before I'd arrived to the precinct. It'd be another hour or so before I made my way to the curbside where her body was found. As per usual, I created a new case directory on my computer, and I punched my standard preparatory case notes in the text editor as I studied the amateur photographs and handwritten testimony provided by the first officer to arrive at the scene. The victim's name was Heather Bennett. The officer's report indicated Heather Bennett did not have a mod around her wrist. I surveyed the images, taking note of even the minor details. These images were truth. And when you arrive at a crime scene, sometimes the truth tends to synthesize with emotion and discord. You only get so many strums out of a guitar before you're out of key, and nobody wants to listen to an out-of-tune guitar. Photo 1. North-facing body shot of Heather. She has blonde, highlighted hair and stick-on vermilion fingernails. She's facing up, legs and torso twisted away from her shoulders and face. Arms are skewed at the elbow with no scrapes on what is observable of her palms. She was surprised, and whatever occurred happened quickly. Her dress is a carnation pink primary with a blue-violet accented trim. Her high heels and calves, they indicate aptitude with social interaction. Her face is nearly indistinguishable from the dried brown blood that conceals her features. There's a 3-inch or so indentation that is identifiable on her forehead. Unanticipated blunt force trauma. Photo 2. A panoramic view of the scene from the opposite sidewalk. Residential. 3 houses within view are simple and maintained with clean-cut front yards and a few clearly cared-for green ash trees, as well as an imposing mature red maple that contrasts Heather's contorted body. There are no blood tracks, just pooling. The crime scene perimeter is not yet set up. A freshly detailed white Audi with Connecticut plates is parked near the curb, misaligned and driver door ajar, indicating a panic-induced reactionary response by a passerby with altruistic intent. Two bystanders stand within gawking distance, blockaded only by Officer Reed's outstretched linebacker arm. Bystander 1. A scruffy, middle-aged man stands square to the ground, stiff and professional. He's grasping a key ring. No blur in the keys or his body indicate he hasn't moved in a few moments. A look of both astonishment and worry plaster his face. He's wearing shorts and a Hawaiian flowered button-up tee. Bystander 2 is a brunette, female, pressing against Officer Reed with one hand and reaching into the air towards the victim with the other. Her body is buckled, eyes bulging, mouth widely open, clearly indicating excruciating distress. Her clothing is an oversized green tank top and blue jeans. Not likely a deliberate decision. She has no shoes on. Away from the intended focus of the photograph, a third bystander. He's alone. It's nearly unperceivable at first glance. He's nondescript. I cannot seem to place a single detail on his clothing, if he is wearing any, nor his stature, not even his posture. The only perceivable feature contrasts strikingly with his shaded outline. A grin, abnormally wide, horrendously fiendish. Black stroke outlines each of his distinguishable teeth, filling the strewn tapestry from ear to ear across his dismal face. I recall my blood pressure increasing as I sat for more than 5 minutes in growing panic, attempting to gather any sort of identifying characteristic of the man in the photograph. The menacing grin. It was the stuff spoken of on stormy nights and depicted in children's nightmares. But here I was, in the middle of a tempest stirring, in the heart of some hypnotic delusion. I placed the small stack of pictures on the desk and I broke away my vision with clenched shut eyes. This was my first encounter with the Cheshire Man. The grimacing man was nowhere to be found when I arrived at the scene where Heather was murdered. I was taken off the case when Inspector Garner received a report that there were concerns that I had become too emotionally invested in the Bennett case. Truth be told, I was extremely invested in that case, but it had nothing to do with emotion. It had everything to do with sensational curiosity. I have never spoken to a living soul about the Cheshire Man. And until penning this letter, there has never even been a documented suggestion that this ghoulish character even existed. Though there has not been a waking moment that I haven't wondered about him. The photographs, they never even raised another eyebrow in the precinct. And the odd man was never mentioned in any testimonies. Which further fueled my curiosity and if the contrast of broad white teeth against the shadowy figure didn't come into focus every time I closed my eyes, I probably would have written it off as some sleep-deprived cognitive mishap or simply fantasy. Unfortunate for me, the Cheshire Man was real. I found myself staring at people's grins in search of a grimace that hinted at a lead to finding this man. Mallory, she made it a point to correct my manners on multiple occasions, God bless her heart. Harry, make eye contact, she'd say somewhat desperately. Forgive him. I'm sure you know how cops can be. Completely socially oblivious, she'd say somewhat desperately. She meant well. Everywhere I went, my focus was on turning over any inkling of a lead to an interaction with the Cheshire Man. I wanted to know something, really anything about him. I just wanted to make him human. Maybe to find out that the man in the photograph was genuinely happy. Maybe that he hadn't seen the carnage on the curb just up ahead. Maybe the caricature depicted in the image wasn't fully in focus and his features' tint were distorted. Maybe he was a good man, placed in a bad moment of time. I see it now. This attempt to find a rational explanation, this was my coping mechanism for that thing. That persistent reminder of what was burned into my vision. Someone or something sinister. Confusion is the enemy of reason. And as a man who's built a career around the ability to rationally weigh nearly every encounter in my life, I had no means of understanding what I had encountered in that crime scene photo. It changed me. My melody shifted from a flowing, logical progression to a muddled and indistinguishable tone. Nobody likes an out-of-tune guitar. It took exactly 4 days for the news statement surrounding Heather Bennett's murder to be formally released to the rabid news media outlets, affording them the opportunity, of course, to tear it apart. The evening news anchors helped themselves to theorizing on why someone so young and susceptible would choose to live without a moment of demise device. I even recall them referring to that device as their guardian angel. A censored image of the crime scene flashed up on the screen briefly, blurring Heather's face as well as the other onlookers. Her wrist was clear and in focus amongst the distortion, emphasizing, of course, that she wore no mod. This was clearly a journalist's photo, taken for the sole purpose of filling a couple minutes of entertainment on the evening news. Bold red letters slid into view at the base of the image. They read, "Modless Murder in Midtown." I'm sure someone got a gold star for that academic bulletin. "I tell you what, Diane." The male anchor's face was plastered with a soulless grin as he spoke, leaning into his female counterpart. She faked interest with a forced look of anticipation and moderate discomfort. I'm certain she hated everything about him. "I can't imagine being seen wearing that dress and those heels if I didn't even have a longevity score. I mean, come on, does she intend to woo her way into normalcy?" He held his stupid grin and paused before the half-witted duo proceeded to blather on, stumbling into another topic. The evening news was a circus, complete with hideous hair and excessive makeup to supplement their freak show performance. Since the device was initially supported by healthcare providers, I've seen dozens of news stories surrounding my cases that operated in false conjecture and inhuman fantasy at the expense of those without a mod. Dozens. I can't say I fault the news networks for being so insensitive. I mean, no mod means absolutely no means of increasing your longevity score. And no longevity score means virtually no social ramifications for making those people out to be clueless Neanderthals. For making normal, modless people out to be suicidal maniacs. Or even a hazard to society. If you've watched the news at all recently, you may not even recognize the heartlessness of what transpired in the reporting of the Bennett murder, and I imagine it might be my fascination with the grimacing man that made me particularly sensitive to the sheer lack of accuracies in the news report I heard. But I sensed it. There was an intentional shift in the focus of this particular report. I could sense that they wanted to drive home the point that Heather's life didn't matter. Sure, her non-existent longevity score mattered, and her mandated mod prescription mattered, but she didn't matter. One might even say that based on that report, Heather Bennett was a nuisance and an impedance on social progress. that the title of the minute-long news report could have just as easily been, "Good Riddance, Heather Bennett." I've come to appreciate that even a shred of brutal honesty is better than volumes of deceitful comfort. Central Investigation Inspector Paul Garner gave me a little breathing room and did whatever he could to keep me busy with office work and off any fresh cases for a few days. He never admitted it, but I'm sure if you asked him, he'd confess to being concerned about me. Concerned I wasn't tracking right. I figured that more than likely he'd spoken with Mallory on one of the times she'd checked in to drop off some lunch. My wife can be too proud a person to simply be direct with me at times, but I can tell. She'd been seeking some reason for my sudden change. They were both right to be concerned, of course. The Cheshire Man continued to haunt me, and he found his way into a recurring series of my night terrors. In my dreams, I would find myself in a seemingly endless apartment corridor. Doors spanned each side of the bug-infested and dimly lit hallway. Lights flickered occasionally, exposing the peeling wall coverings only momentarily. I was searching for a new room with a homicide victim, recollecting the room number from my failing memory. Panic sets in, as I'd realize there's no exit, and the case file's still on my precinct desk. Smells of rotting food and abandoned trash would begin to permeate my senses as I began to seek any hint of a logical lead. I would begin to walk briskly, the hallway behind me fading into obscurity, while the endless faded carpet would reveal before me like a hamster on a running wheel. Eyes jotted left and right, focusing on the unsystematic room numbers for something to jog my memory, and then I felt it. Something staring at me. The hair on the back of my neck would stand at attention, and I feared looking behind me. It was him. The Cheshire Man. Grimacing while he walked only a few steps behind me. I could sense the hilarity he felt in seeing my panic. I knew that I'd missed my door, and he stepped through it. My brisk walk would turn into a full sprint, heart racing as I began to completely ignore the room numbers. This was now a fight for my survival.
I'm coming for you.
Calmly echoed behind me, distorted and barely recognizable, but echoing and close enough to keep me in a full sprint. As fatigue set in, I would hear a distant screech and a plead for help, a plead for mercy. He had found another victim. I was safe for now. I never saw the Cheshire Man, but I knew he had picked another casualty to his sick debaucheries. And as I would turn to catch a glimpse, I'd wake with a gasp. I tried opening doors a few nights. I never found one unlocked. I wasn't sleeping much. Night after night, my bed called for me, whispering softly of scents of clean linen and cool bedspreads. And night after night, I awoke from the vivid hallucinatory conjuring to the sense of somebody watching me. Night after night, I pitched the comfort of my bedroom companion, soaked in muggy sweat, and I took to exploring the streets of Manhattan. I'd dissolve into the dissident night crawlers until the first hint of dawn before returning home. It wasn't long before I noticed that the nights were full of risks, devoid of mods. I felt oddly connected to the dark corroborators and shady streetwalkers. Death was an unexpected mystery for these people. A suspense novel with surprise plot twists. Regardless of their intention, these were free folk. My kind. I could feel the eyes peering at my wrist as I crossed paths with the characters of the night. I also felt their acceptance when they confirmed there was no glow of a mod permeating their obscure securities. I felt safe. They would keep me from my nightmares. From the grimacing Cheshire Man trying to haunt me. Mallory worried, but she never questioned my motives or whereabouts.
Inspector Garner came and visited me in the evidence room towards the end of one of my typical shifts. I'd been sealed away in what was affectionately known as the cage. I was verifying seals and logs for nearly 3 days. It was repetitive, and it took very little intellectual rigor to alphabetize and confirm weights and paperwork. It was the perfect job to dole out my edgy corners.
"Never seen this room so structured." Garner held a manila envelope. "I've got something for you. Fresh case."
My heart fluttered. My ears slowly ignited as my heart picked up speed. I set down the chain of custody forms and glanced up at the chief inspector.
"You've been keeping busy, and I know you've got a lot on your mind. Are you ready for this, Healy?"
Garner held up his wrist to take a quick peek at his mod, and then he proceeded to extend the case file to me.
"You know," he hesitated, "there's been an uptick in homicide indicators. I worry about you and Mallory. Look, I know you're an old dog. And this mod technology, well, it's a new trick. I get it. But it works, Healy. It works, and it could help give you a little bit of peace of mind. Look, I'd love to even invite you guys to some of the longevity events. Honestly, you're a valued member of the force, and I'd even compromise some of our higher engagement activities just to get you two involved." He wanted to say more. The blood had calmed in my face and ears as I smirked, snatching the folder from his hand.
"Healy, huh?"
"Yeah. It's catchy. Let me know if you're not ready for this. If you'd like someone else to take that file, we can arrange that."
My lips held a stern smirk. Not quivering, not searching for next words. Garner knew there was nothing more for either of us to say. He turned to leave, and as he badged out of the cage, he paused for a moment. I could practically hear the smile in his voice.
"You're a stubborn old dog, Healy."
There was both a rush of eagerness and anxiety that swiftly coaxed me to my desk. I recall pausing for a moment prior to opening the case file. Between the copy machine, the overtoned laughter, the glug of the water cooler, there was just too much interference to safely detail this case. I had, up until now, proven successful in the delicate severance of the outside influence from the factual. I could hear busy murmuring of office duties around me. They seemed to grow louder, then they'd quiet, distorting subtly with the pulsing volume. Shuffled in the phasing volume, I heard it. Subtle, but clear. "I'm coming for you." I felt nauseous, and I stared at the haphazardly stuffed file, trying to lock eyes with the stationary object, any stationary object. Case file 177534, Dustin Harmon. The numbers and letters seemed a kaleidoscope, sliding left and right, up and down on the case file.
"I'm sorry?"
Grace, the front desk assistant, paused and turned to me, two cups of coffee in her hand. Her voice pierced through the swirling chaos, and all at once, everything calmed.
"You say something, Harry?"
No, Grace. My apologies, I was just thinking out loud. She leaned in and handed me a cup of coffee, smiling with a stern look of concern.
"You ain't looking right, Harry. Here, I got this cup for Ted, but I'll go get another. You taking care of yourself?"
"Thanks, Grace. No, I'm fine. I think I need to schedule an eye doctor appointment is all. Say, Grace, could you read this address for me?" I held open the pages of the case file.
That's Seward Park, near the pier off Broadway. Harry, do yourself a favour and don't get your eyes checked before you go. You may not want to see what I'm seeing.
Grace's face reflected something ugly on the crime scene photo as she straightened her back and turned to walk away.
If you mug me up, I'm coming for you.
Her voice sounded unnatural. Excuse me? I stood and reached out, grabbing her shoulder firmly.
Harry, let go of me. I said take care of yourself.
She turned her head to look at me. Fear dotted her eyes.
You're hurting me.
I'm so sorry. I...
Seward Park. Better hurry.
Grace glared at her maud and began to shuffle off towards the break room to fetch another cup of coffee to gossip over. I seared my tongue and throat by gulping down my scorching hot cup before grabbing the case file and heading towards the door. Grace later told me that I left bruise marks on her shoulder and her upper back. Seward Park was bustling with onlookers around the established crime scene perimeter when I arrived. There were a number of officers assigned to boundary duty, requesting people to leave the area, and by the look of frustration in their eyes, I could tell the grace period was over. They were transitioning from a simple, no congregating request to a more formal demand. Mauds glistened from the small multitude, reflecting from the late morning sun to create a unity of brilliant vivacity. No worry was on anyone's face as they onlooked whatever murderous tragedy lay on the other side of the plastic yellow barricade. Their jubilance made me sick. As I stepped out of my car, I couldn't help but feeling like I should stop, get back in my vehicle and just drive away. I could get some rest, wake up tonight, come back. I could meet the transients that filled up the park at night. Grateful for another day alive. I'll bet they had a take on whatever transpired within those barricades. An impartial, uninfluenced opinion. No one else in this sparkling mess could offer that. Against my better judgment, I pursued the center of the 3-acre park. I pushed through the crowd, badge held high to clear the masses. I could feel their eyes peering at me. I could hear the whispered judgments from the concerned mothers to their children. I heard a man's voice cut through the gasping commotion.
He won't be alive much longer, the way things are these days.
It dawned on me, midway through the crowd. They weren't stepping away to make room for an NYPD badge. They were fleeing from a diseased, maudless monster. And I can still feel the wrenching, gut-knotting hurt of that moment when I give it a thought. I was a leper in a cleansed society, and they didn't want any association with my contagious illness. As I neared the edge of the parting sea of gawkers, I felt it once again. That moment, that someone was watching me. Intently. Passionately. Deviously. Given the gathering of submissive and silent judges that crowded my peripherals, I began to question my state of wakefulness. I didn't dare let my eyes stray from the scene demarcation line. Any moment I'd hear a pitiful scream from the crowd and awake from my slumber. I'd possibly wake up in the evidence room, just before Inspector Garner sacrificed me to another news headline birthed in conformity. Maybe I'd regain consciousness in the alleyway. Safe from modern surveillance, safe from monitoring of my life, my intentions, of my dreams. With any luck, I'd wake in my bed just as the birds began their morning song, before Heather Bennett, before the Cheshire Man. Through the waves of eroding whispers, I heard it. No louder than a stern, soft-spoken voice in an unnaturally deep octave.
I'm coming for you. Oh, I'm coming for you.
I picked up speed in my walk, face forward. There were likely 2 or 3 children that suffered minor injuries from my barreling through the crowd. no longer waiting for the scoffers to step aside. The voice called out one last time as I lifted the barricade and crossed the finish line. I'd never heard him in such a desperate and excited tone. It still chills my spine to this moment thinking of that excited yell, like a hyena screeching laughter during the thrill of running down their prey to the ground. Once I crossed the line, the panic ceased immediately. Safe. However, it was at this moment that I realized I wasn't dreaming. The victim was a young male, straggly and thin with natural good looks. His face was visible and the rest of his corpse was covered by blue polyester tarp, indicating mutilation not fit for the masses of onlookers. My focus was not initially on the crime scene or the presumed mutilated torso of the young man. I wanted to see his wrist. I wanted to know if he could have escaped the clutches of tragedy that befell him. As I reached under the tarp with my gloved hands, I felt the firm, balled-up fist of Detective Graham pummel my shoulder with a friendly unction.
Healy, it's good to see you back on the case.
He held out his hand to shake mine, which was predisposed in a mad hunt for Ahmad. They'd taken special care to tuck the tarp under Dustin, whose name I recalled from the case file cover sheet. It'd be too difficult to check his wrist and nearly impossible to be discreet in my intentions. I nonchalantly pulled my hand and forearm out from the tarp and turned to return the handshake.
Graham, it's nice to see daylight again. Want to grab some coffee after this?
I can just about imagine. You must have been going stir-crazy. I'd love to sit down and catch up. Where's the nearest no-mod cafe around here?
Graham paused, realizing the insensitivity behind what he'd just asked.
I'm sorry, Healy. Look, I honestly don't know how you can get in any place without a mod these days.
I forced a smile. Yeah, don't worry about it. Callahan's. It's just a few miles up the road. They've got good coffee, too. I looked at Dustin, cocooned and still, and forced the topic back to why we were both here. What's under the tarp?
Had to wrap him up and throw another tarp over him for the kids. And the adults, I guess. He's missing some substantial pieces of flesh all over his torso, his shoulders, his neck, his back.
I hadn't looked up once at the onlooking crowd until this point, and I noticed that the crowd had died down substantially since I arrived. I have to chuckle now, reader, as I'm nearly convinced I solidified some suspicions of the modless being insane. I'm certain I look terrible. Pale from worry, agitated from lack of sleep, and sickly from unhealthy weight loss. I was a nauseating mess.
Yeah, it looks like they're clearing out, I said. Let's have a look at Dustin. You said skin avulsions.
Bacterial?
Untreated necrosis, maybe?
I never said skin avulsions. I said he was missing pieces of flesh. Did you see the photos? You know what to expect with this one, right?
Graham dug his hand under the corpse in search of a seam in the tarp.
Healy, have you seen this case file?
Actually, No, I was having issues with my focus back at the office, I said.
Well, I'll show you this, but I'll warn you now. The missing flesh,
Healy, there's saliva around every missing piece. These are bite marks, brother. I stopped for a moment and looked out at the crowd. This wouldn't be pretty, and I wanted to ensure children were gone. I scanned clockwise around the perimeter, taking note of the general ages of the few remaining. Mostly men. The sounds of the cars on the adjacent busy street became more focused as I quickly finalized my verification check. No kids. I felt much better about exposing Dustin's body. Just as I began to look down, something caught my eye. A man, in an unusual top hat, stood on the south sidewalk staring intensely towards the scene. His face held no emotion. He was distant, both physically and emotionally, and the constant stream of cars made it difficult to know what he was truly looking at. His body posture was noticeably slanted at the waist, as if he had a crooked spine. I could understand those that had gathered to rubberneck at a mutilated corpse, but This man was purposefully and intently staring at something altogether different.
The thing is, Healy, that these are unusually large bite marks, and...
Graham's voice came back into focus as I heard him roll the victim's body out of the tarp.
We'll have to wait for the results, but they don't look like a dog attack. If it was a dog, he was a surgeon in a past life.
I looked down to see something I hadn't seen in 18 years on the force. Deep, skinless grooves riddled his body from neck down to calves, clearly exposing muscle fibers, fat tissue, tendons, and bone. Gnaw marks filled in the places where the skin wouldn't tear away easily. They were incisor, canine, and molar imprints that were clearly visible. This was no dog that tore into Dustin. This was clearly a ravenous person, insane with ecstasy over what he was doing. Graham was talking me through his theories, but I wasn't listening. I looked up to see the man in the top hat. He hadn't moved so much as an inch. His face remained painted precisely the same as before. Something in his blank stare caused shivers down my spine. I stared at him for quite some time before, quickly and decisively, his eyes darted, twitching in their sockets to peer immediately with mine, almost as if he were a porcelain doll on a shelf, lifeless body, and eyes tracking my own as I passed by. He wore a business suit, filthy and tattered as if he hadn't taken it off after sweating over yard work for days on end. I stepped forward, eyes locked with the soulless man. Graham continued to blather on, clueless that I wasn't aware of his words. The wind had stopped. The birds had quieted. All of time seemed to pause while I studied the man across the street. Then, all at once, and in a twisted and unnatural way, the man's head snapped quickly down as he raised his maud. After a long moment, from the left and right brim of his top hat, I saw something odd. His cheekbones began to slowly protrude, stretching unnaturally wide and sharp in angles. He slowly lifted his enlarged head, and to my horror, he held a grimace. I was all too familiar with this wicked smile. It haunted me in my night terrors and when I closed my eyes. In his wicked tapestry of a stretched, ear-to-ear smile, tendrils of flesh and crimson stains were clearly visible in contrast with his brilliant, pearl-like teeth. In this moment, I had no discernible thoughts, only confounded emotion. I was staring at the blurred, indistinguishable apparition from the Heather Bennett case. Pointy, triangular angles bulged from his cranium, stretching his jawline to accommodate the terrifying, blood-spattered smile. He had come back, possibly never left the scene of his ravenous handiwork on Dustin's body. To see the shocked faces of onlookers surrounding the jigsawed corpse lying lifeless in the park. He was proud of what he'd done. I looked down quickly to check Dustin's now exposed wrist. There was no maud, and no tan lines indicating he'd never even had a moment of demise device. Why? Why Dustin Harmon? Why Heather Bennett? I looked back up at the Cheshire man with what I'm certain was a noticeable look of confusion. His grimace, his slanted posture, neither had shifted or quivered in the slightest. He slowly lifted his thin arm, and with his other hand he pointed at his maud, tapping the glass repetitively. Tick, tick, tick. Through the menacing smile, the Cheshire man mouthed the words, "I'm coming for you, detective," and turned to step out of focus behind the array of speeding vehicles. Hey, thanks for listening to this episode of Grey Matters Podcast. I really hope you've enjoyed it and would consider giving me a positive rating or even becoming a Patreon supporter of the show. This helps me to continue producing the memorable stories that you love on a consistent basis. Being a sustaining supporter has some pretty cool perks, including regular giveaways, exclusive forums for writers and fans of the show, chances at having your stories hosted on Grey Matters, and access to exclusive interviews and workshops with me, the writer and producer of the show, Brandon Kenyon. Become a supporter today at www.patreon.com/greymatterspodcast. And remember, that's G-R-E-Y Matters Podcast. You can also find us on the web at www.greymatterspodcast.net for our online store and some other great resources. Look, we love what we do, and it's a tremendous amount of work. The creative writing, the original music, the obsessive editing and producing. But honestly, it's worth every second put into making something if it brings out a smile, a laugh, maybe a tear, a sense of wonder, momentary terror, or spurs conversations in our listeners and supporters. We do it for you, and we'd love to hear your thoughts or questions. Contact us directly by emailing contact@greymatterspodcast.net. Remember, that's G-R-E-Y. Today's episode was written and produced by Brandon Kenyon. We hope that you'll be joining us next time for another episode of Grey Matters.